Yeah, so welcome everyone back after the short coffee break. I would like to present the next speaker, which is Monika Joneja. She's an art historian and a professor for global art history at the Cluster of Excellence Asia and Europe in a global context at University of Heidelberg. She published widely, and I have to say very widely, on questions what a transcultural art history can mean today, which includes her constant questioning of modernist notions of art, which are still very valid today, which is also means introducing different notion of aesthetic concepts which are not determined by Western philosophies. This is one like major field of her topic. And I think with respect to our conference, well, we have already discussed these questions on also geopolitical grounds, which risk you can take in relational art. So this is certainly not only a question of the law, but also certainly in which state you interfere, or in which do you interfere as a citizen, do you interfere as a cosmopolitan, do you interfere as a private subject? So what is your self-understanding, and how does this relate to how you conceive of a public space in which you interfere? And saying this, one of the maybe threats or risks relational art can take is to be no longer art, not to be recognized as art. And I think this is very crucial to the question of the vernacular, which Monika is addressing, and this also relates back to what Ines brought up with the question of purity, impurity, or so-called dirt. So I would like to welcome Monika. She's also a frequent and always very welcome guest to our PhD training group. And she will present today a paper with the title, Have You Ever Touched the River? Relational Art Practice Between the Metropolitan and the Vernacular. And I think there's more written there, but I can't read it. Okay, so Monika.
Thank you, Susanna, for that kind introduction. And thank you so much, Beate and Alia, for inviting me to this really very exciting exchange. And I think the two papers of the morning by Ines and Heba set the tone very nicely for the kinds of issues and tangled problems that we are going to be engaging with. You can hear me at the back, can't you? Yeah. I have to apologize for my slightly croaky voice, as many of us, I caught a cold last night. Okay, so the starting point of this symposium, as proposed by the organizers, and I quote, is the experience of participatory engaged art to bring together different disciplines, perspectives, and states of geopolitical situatedness into the conversation, end unquote. As art historians and scholars of visual studies, we know participatory art as an open form of praxis where the distinction between viewers, participants, and actors gets blurred, and where political and artistic modes of articulation blend into each other. Our understanding, and this is, I talk about when we study and teach art history at the university level, this understanding of participatory and or relational art, has been built upon what has become a set of canonical writings, starting with the thoughts on relational aesthetics that were put forward by Nicolas Bourriaud, and that we all know engendered intensive discussions, and this was followed by the critical position taken by Claire Bishop. And I think this is the kind of work that continues to define the parameters of what we know as participatory art. I think Ines, in a presentation this morning, kind of extended it, spelled it out in more detail. So it's, I was, when I got the first version of the program, I was delighted to see that Bishop was initially envisaged here as a speaker at this forum, because the early version of the program carried her name, and I really would have welcomed the opportunity to have this conversation with her face to face, because I start with her work, and yet also I think with it, but also beyond it from the position of a historian, of art historian of South Asia. So let me start with what Bishop has laid down on the subject. And she draws on a series of, you know, fascinating case studies drawn from a very particular post-1989 European context. And from this then she extracts this broad characterization of participatory praxis, even though she herself then, after having sort of defined its contours, proceeds to nuance and refine it through the course of a book. So I kind of use that as a framing statement. Now, her characterization goes as follows, where she describes the artist as a collaborator rather than a creator, a co-producer of situations rather than discrete objects. And it's a characterization which conceptualizes the work of art as a process rather than an end product, and is ongoing with no clear beginning and end. And moreover, and this is what, you know, I've kind of been working with, Bishop conceives of participatory art as a, and these are her words, as a delegated and dematerialized performance. The delegation involves what she calls a delegation of power by the artist to those outside of the artistic fold, which relocates authenticity away from a singular artist. It also keeps open a space of risk and ambiguity with unproductive results. At the same time, she considers this as a move to undermine institutional authority provoked by, again, and she uses the word here, amateurism. Actually, she also calls it institutional perversion. And finally, the question as to the extent to which participation or relational practices end up delinking themselves from visual art, rejecting the inventive quality of art itself. This remains an unresolved issue, and I will return to it at the end. Now let us, in the next step, bring this conception of the participatory together with some other issues that were outlined for this discussion, and an important one being that of vernacular practices and their appropriation, and they are said to be to result in this inevitable process of abstraction. Okay, so that's another question I want to talk about. Now, my presentation, even as I think with Bishop, I also want to rethink the parameters of relational art practice beyond the canon, which to me seems to rest on certain oppositions, you know, such as situations versus objects, process versus product, inside stroke outside the artistic world, or more implicitly, a positioning of spaces beyond the gallery against those of institutions. And I think these arguments in turn build on an understanding of institutional critique whose genealogies go back to the avant-garde of the early 20th century. And together they've produced a theoretical frame that builds, understandably, on a particular, you know, provincial experience. So we have to be careful about, you know, universalizing that experience. And so in this presentation, I also hope to make a larger argument about theory building, you know, that is when we seek to make experiences and experiments from regions beyond Euro-America, when we seek to make these globally intelligible, what are the implications for the way we use certain concepts or theorize on the basis of one set of findings? So my talk then will look at a particular experiment with participatory art from South Asia that steps out of it and folds beyond the domain of art institutions. As Bishop's study proposes, it resorts to a mode of delegated performance in that it seeks a form of sharing whose results are largely unforeseen. And even as it ends in the rematerialization of the process. Indeed, for me, mutuality and materiality are from the start not opposing poles within this experiment. Rather, excuse me, sorry. Co-production unfolds in the interstices between the two, and it unfolds in the interstices to reaffirm the place of the work within the art institution. In fact, it does not seek to delegitimize the authority of the art institution, though it does aspire to undermine the hegemony of a particular division of labor, to in fact redefine artistic labor as conjoining ethics, risk, and pleasure. And in this work, I remain with the artist. I remain with an individual artist, and it is through the work of the individual artist I want to raise all these issues, which also then, you know, is about co-production. And how we rethink the position of the artist in this. And it's the artist, Atul Bhalla, that, you know, and it's a work that takes as its starting point a journey of, quote unquote, thinking with the river. The river here is a particular river, the river Yamuna, that flows through the city of Delhi. This is where Bhalla lives and works. And this provides the core of, for his incessant engagement with water. His work on water, as you can read in some of these lines that he has himself penned, it alternates between different stances. You know, at times, as you see here, it explores the meaning of water with all the cultural markers kept out. You know, it's about feeling, drinking, wading, about water as fog, as mist, as steam or tears. You know, here he speaks of water, you know, in these lines here, you know, on a planetary register, you know, of a primal and shared biology. And then on other occasions, his concerns shift from the planetary to the local, to the river Yamuna that flows through and past Delhi. And it's a river that's deeply embedded in a cultural context. So his projects are all about the so-called disconnect between the city and the river. And he questions, in fact, every inhabitant of Delhi, you know, goes out into the streets of Delhi and plasters the city with stickers like these or posters, questioning them about their relationship to the river. And, you know, in his discussions, he voices this concern about the ways in which the city has turned its architectural back to the river. You know, the river today is, you know, Delhi is one of the most polluted cities of the world, as you know, and the river is choked with effluence. You know, there are walls that hide the river from public view. People have no access to the river because of barricades. The only access is through death, because the cremation grounds are located on the banks of the river. Now, one of Bhalla's artistic projects was the Yamuna Walk project, where he walks along a 22-kilometer stretch adjacent to Delhi, where he recorded his wanderings. He describes in rich detail, and which includes also the degradation that has taken place, you know, thanks to extreme pollution and uncontrolled urbanization. And this is within a tradition that sees rivers as sacred. And his images show that the worship of the river, the worship of the Yamuna as a goddess, does not secure the river from the brutality that follows from religious practice, in which both corpses and medical waste are consigned to the waters of his river. So much of his work then records this conflation of reverence and abuse in a very matter-of-fact way. The project I wish to discuss here goes back to 2013, and this is another dimension of Bhalla's ongoing preoccupation with water, because it also intersects with his interest in wood. You know, wood is both a receptacle of water, and it's a material with which boats were once made. And this ties it then to the communities who live in symbiosis with the river and who work with their hands and with their knowledge and their materials, and passing on embodied knowledge from one generation to another. So entering into a relationship with them becomes for him a journey to investigate layers of time and history. Now, on one of his journeys along the river, that and which often took him beyond the kind of metropolis of Delhi, Bhalla encountered a boatman repairing a boat that was made entirely out of wood. And after, you know, if in the vicinity of Delhi, the boats that you, the modern boats that you observe are made out of synthetic material or aluminium. And he was riveted by this boat and enters into a conversation with his interlocutor about where these kinds of boats come from, who makes them. And this was to become a journey along the river to distant towns and villages to search for a particular kind of boat and those who continued to possess the know-how, how to craft it. Now, this is the story of a search which he narrates step by step. So what I'm telling you is based really on his narration. I think his production of this work is this narrative. And not knowing where it would end, what would it would bring forth was entirely uncertain and unforeseen. So both the narration and the process constitute this work which he called The Wake. Now, in one of the villages, he encounters then the members of such a boat maker's community who embodies this knowledge passed down from his ancestors, but he had not used this knowledge as this particular kind of boat is no longer in demand. You know, boat makers now have taken to other occupations to make a living. Now, the coming up of bridges mean that they don't need the boats that much. So this particular kind of boat then was characteristic of the lower Ganges basin. It was called, the indigenous term for it was a pattaya. It's a transport boat made by nailing together long wooden planks, a boat that's today no longer in demand. So he continues the travel in the company of this young man whom he met, and he goes to another village some 105 kilometers east, again based, you know, these are kinship ties that connect people to places. And this is on the banks of a smaller river, the tributary of the Ganges, with the village of Gani, and where members of the extended family of this young man were living, family and community, also members of an older generation. And here he meets a family of boatmen. And the three important people who are part of this project, on the top left is Subhash, below him is his son, Ram Mohan, and on the right-hand side is a maternal uncle. And the Hindi word for a maternal uncle is Mamaji, and everybody in the village, including Bhalla himself, addressed him as Mamaji. So the project then is about Bhalla's assimilation into this community of different generations, a community of closely knit kinship ties. And so begins a collective enterprise. They first search for the right kind of wood from the neighboring forest to make a boat like this, and then to acquiring, you know, particular materials and tools, you know, for example, these long square nails made by artisans themselves in the village. These are all handmade. There's no synthetic waterproofing material that is used. Rather, it's the tree resin that's used to fill the crevices on the wood. Here are the nails, and here's this one more. And then the detailed and finely tuned calculations of size and proportion, you know, to maintain the balance, the angles of the curves, to calculate the amount of wood required. And these were made by both Subhash and his family. Both these men hardly went to school, but it was really, again, through elders of the family that this knowledge was acquired. And I think, again, the narrative that Palla gives us expresses admiration, you know, at the accuracy, for example, in calculating the amount of wood you required. So it was a large boat. The size was calculated according, you know, the size of boats was calculated according to the number of buffaloes a boat could carry. So this one was a 5-buffalo boat. And it was a process of about 2 months of collective work. It took place partly in this village here, and then they moved to Delhi, to the banks of the river Jamuna, where the boat was crafted. And this is what it looks like. This. Now, this was an investigative process on the part of the artist, Palla, to understand and live through long-established contacts. For him, it was a move to reconnect with the practices and knowledge that is no longer dead, and to connect the actors there and those who embodied that knowledge to another set of places and institutions, which is his world, you know, of art. And it was at this time that the interest of this Heritage Transport Museum in Gurgaon — Gurgaon is one of the satellite towns on the outskirts of Delhi — it was the museum that expressed an interest to acquire this boat for its collection. And of course, it wanted to have the boat immediately, insisting that a museum object needs to be untouched by water. And yet, this was a process that had to be consummated collectively. So following the completion of the boat, first was a series of rituals, you know, rituals of consecration, I mean prayers, to 4 different kinds of gods: the god and the goddess of the river, the god of the tools of labor. But this consecration was complete only after the boat was taken out onto the river. And again, bringing out the reverence that many continue to experience onto the river. And then you come on to the river. And it was at this point that the artist, Palla, expresses his wish for an extra rudder for the boat, you know, on each side. And his co-producers were puzzled. They were even horrified. I mean, if you have 2 rudders, how do you make the boat move? But they complied in the end. And once on the river — so you have these 2 rudders — and once on the river, you find that the stagnant water of the river does not flow. So you have these 2 rudders, and it meant that the boat went around in circles. So after this process of conservation, the final stage in the process was the installation of the boat. This is the boat in the Museum of Transport. So you have now this grid of interspersed courts and voids, so this network of visual encounters that you see on the slide. I can't see my slide here because the light is very bright. And you can see that the museum levels are vertically connected to create these full height voids from the topmost down to the lowest level, where you see the a cafe. So this allows you these different views of the of the exhibit. You know, a view from below, you know, is likely to arouse curiosity, because it reveals the underside of the boat, and then these fragmented reflections through mirror clad beams. And then, here's one. And then from the top, you know, if you walk around the installation and you view it at eye level, that's when the sense of the dramatic or the spectacular is lost, and the viewer is left to engage with the work without embellishments. And so here was the boat, and then in the gallery was the artist's work, you know, which are photographs. So it was a form of co-production that strives not to subsume different authorships and collectively embodied labor and art of making within the creation of a singular artist. But before I return to some of these issues of collaborative praxis, I want to look at another work which goes back to 2008, and this was an installation created for an urban art festival in Delhi. The title of the festival was 48 degrees Celsius. It refers to one of the hottest summers the city had known. And this installation was entitled Chabil. Okay, it is created in a historical part of Delhi known as Kashmiri Gate. This is the northernmost edge of an earlier 17th century Mughal capital, Shah Jahanabad. So there's a, you know, which is a walled city within the present urban conglomeration of Delhi. Until the mid-19th century, the river had flown close to the ramparts of the old city wall. And if you look at maps of the time, they show you this. And today, it's more or less inaccessible because it's separated by a heavily trafficked road and it's barely noticeable from the ramparts of the old city wall. So this installation then was intended to draw attention to the way the city had become visually and materially disconnected from the waters that had once gushed close to it. The Chabil is a Punjabi word, and it refers to a custom in northwestern India to the practice of giving free drinking water to travelers and passers-by during the hot summer months. It's an act that builds community. The person who gives out the water is the one who's, you know, who's in a more humble position because he believes that it's done in the name of God. And it's this community practice that's reanimated in this installation. You know, the installation takes this form of this giant white, we call it a jerry can. I don't know what you call it here. It's a container used to transport water. And it's faced with white tiles, and it turns out to be a kiosk from which Atul Bhalla dispensed water to the thirsty visitors who came, and he does this in recyclable paper cups. So this is filtered water from the river Jamuna. And the people are requested, as you can see the notice up there, to leave their cups on the counter with the dregs of water left behind in the cups. And these dregs of water were mixed with sand from the river and cement. And so this produced solidified small blocks of concrete. And these mini monuments were collected in the Chabil with the intent of creating a larger monument to the river. So again, co-produced by each passerby who was, you know, who participated in this act of drinking water. And on leaving the kiosk, each person was given a sticker to take home, which asked, have you seen the Yamuna? Have you ever touched the river? Now, this idea of co-production is tied also to an indigenous notion, you know, associated with caste purity. The Hindi word for it is jute. And it's a Hindi word. It describes a concept, and according to the artist, he says this is a very quote-unquote Eastern concept. It's not translatable into English. But I can try and explain. Jute stands for the bodily trace of a person left on a glass or a vessel from which he or she would have drunk or eaten something. So it's marked by your saliva, you know, your DNA, as Bhalla put it. And this idea is tied to the imagination of ritual purity and pollution. You know, once you you have drunk or eaten from a vessel, no one will use it till it is cleansed. And in the case of the lower, the quote-unquote untouchable castes, it remains indelibly polluted. So the artist's conception was of treating each person's waste or jute as part of a participatory act that is then rematerialized into an object. You know, it would be solidified as an inextricable part of a monument to the river. And the participants in the process were acutely aware of the exclusivity of their own jute or bodily waste and its merging into the collectivity of the monument. Okay, so in a concluding statement, I would like to return to some of the questions I raised at the start. in an effort to pluralize our understandings of participatory art and relational aesthetics. I wish to argue for a less oppositional, more symbiotic understanding of the process. And participation, which I've tried to show, is no longer the need to rest on delegation to those outside of the artistic fold or amateurism. Rather, it draws both its dynamism and its quality of the unforeseen from a move to break out of this inside-outside divide and by opening up institutional spaces by extending participatory possibilities to those excluded. And I think this is an issue, a major issue in South Asia. I think we can talk about it a little later. And in the long term, would then work towards transforming the epistemic foundations of both the sites of art making and exhibition, as well as of the canonical discourses that make sense of these. The risk here is this may not happen. The work of Atul Bhalla, to take one example, consciously seeks to conjoin the conceptual to the artisanal, the material and the vernacular. And his is a pursuit of an understanding built into art making of South Asia, you know, a conception that had been relegated to the margins, first in the wake of advancing modernist ideologies, and then more recently as a consequence of globalized forms of labor that are harnessed to the production of, you know, gigantic artworks for public spaces. Now, last summer, in this exciting workshop we had in Lüneburg, you know, of this research group that revisits art criticism in a critical post-colonial frame, I had argued that introducing an artisanal epistemology, which you can define as an ensemble of technical skills, manual skills, technical procedures, and material practices, introducing this as a pillar of art history would take us really beyond the individual artist whom art history tends to canonize as a pinnacle of creativity and instead look for a more distributed urgency. And I had said that this approach can show you the way, you know, beyond the existing compass of the discipline and its hierarchy of genres, and which has this, these hierarchies have actually migrated to regions of the non-European world, often in the wake of colonialism. And art histories in younger post-colonial nations today have also frequently ended up assimilating existing distinctions such as art versus artifact or craft, and which downgrade or exclude many historically and aesthetically significant kinds of objects and practices from consideration, and that today these challenge our scholarship to find, you know, plausible ways of unsettling these. So our discussion then of the sampling of work that I showed you suggests that, you know, dematerialized practice as a founding principle of participatory art, in the sense that Bishop deploys it, it can work for all its emancipatory possibilities. It can also work towards privileging an exclusive regional understanding of this nexus of participation, aesthetics, and criticism. So my argument is to make materiality central to the experience of art, to its production and reception, because this would help us pluralize our understanding of concepts such as vision, and this would help make art history more capacious for synesthetic notions of sight, you know, an understanding of seeing beyond the purely ocular, you know, and which tend to prevail in different world cultures. Now, as I stated in the outset, this experiment in participatory art steps out and unfolds beyond the domain of art institutions, but it sets back into them, only to relocate the act back into the world of art. And Atul Bhalla's engagement with vernacular practices of making culminates in their rematerialization into these co-produced, museumized objects. So what does this mean then for the possibility of institutional critique, you know, said to be built in the notion of the participatory? And here too, I'd like to look at the trajectory of institutional critique as the idea took roots in localities beyond the West. Now, an established understanding of the canonized formative moment of such critique, which is avant-garde modernism. You know, this is one that reads critique in terms of a privileging of both technical advancement and an attack on established institutions and academic codes of art. And it's really an understanding that draws upon Euro-American metropolitan definitions, and which does not consider the transculturation of the avant-garde when it travels and finds roots beyond the West. Because when we turn our gaze elsewhere and observe how modernist experiments unfolded, these unfolded at sites that did not have established and complex institutional frameworks. Rather, they required creating new institutions rather than rebelling against non-existent ones. So, you know, it needed to create journals, exhibition spaces, art schools, and foundations. So institutional critique from the very start actually involved working with and later beyond institutions. But at the same time, I don't want to kind of reify this point of view, because we are aware that institutional critique itself has not remained static since its founding moment in any part of the world. It has also undergone reinvention and generational shifts in response to changing and difficult contemporary conditions. Today, there's a crisis of liberal democracies that cuts across the globe, and the critique of neoliberal capitalism and its concomitant evasion of both social and environmental responsibility. And this goes also hand in hand with the kind of growing artistic internationalism that inhabits this fluid space between art and activism. And so it all means that institutional critique is now being reinvented across continental distances. And to come back to this morning's discussion about risk, there is a kind of shared risk which then, however, opens up into a kind of a gamut of possibilities. We saw the possibilities this morning between what Innes was describing and what Heba was describing. And I think the degree and nature of the possibility of risk differs according to context, as Susanna also pointed out. And one of the major risks, I think, is that the spaces in which such experiments unfold are risk no longer to be available in the face of, you know, repression, censorship, increased controls. That's one possibility. And especially when I think of the possibility of South Asia, I think that the repression and the policing comes not only from the state, but also from different kinds of social communities, especially where caste is an important factor, and this ties up with what the work Balla does. I'll just come to it in a minute. Okay, so so critique then has taken the form of what Gerald Raunig defines as instituent practice, a practice that, in his words, thwarts the logic of institutionalization, invents new forms of instituting that do not oppose institutions, but, and again, these are his words, flee from institutionalization and structuralizations. So the strategies and competencies of art here, according to him, can be deployed to spur on a general reflection on the problem of institutions. Now, shifting our gaze back to present-day South Asia, the work of contemporary artists, including Balla, is part today of a global circuit, and as a result of which they develop networks of affinity that cut across national boundaries, you know, what Ranjit Hoskote calls trans-regional affinities. At a local level, this critique takes the form of a practice of radical social questioning, which, however, does not necessarily adopt a position of distance from institutions. critique grows from a conjoining, often indirect, of political positions and social movements. And in the Indian context, and especially this work with these communities from the villages, it's really, it's cast as a basis of skilled and unskilled labor, which is in a very important terrain, which is where this critique unfolds. But without renouncing a belief in artistic competence, and here I come back to Bishop, in the inventive power of artistic creation to envisage the possibilities of an alternative yet unseen future without setting aside the possibilities within the art field. Rather, the attempt to live a different form of artistic labor and make place within institutions defined by their exclusivity to visualize and materialize and revalorize this labor as through the object. So the classical avant-garde dictum that there can be art without the artwork is turned on its head, even as the formalization of the work or its processes move in and out of an institutional field. And I think the risk is the risk which attaches to all institutional structures where this kind of move may or may not, be sustainable. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Monica. I think we have time for a very, very short discussion, and I'm looking forward to the final panel in the evening so that we can extend the discussion on your important contribution, because I think in a way, I don't know whether you agree, in a way it shows a certain paradox of relational art. and we could say that the biggest problem in relational art is art. So... and I wonder, because even the example you showed, and even with the whole attempt of transgressing certain divisions of labor, you showed perfectly that it still is confined, and the artist starts off as an artist, so that there is already a whole set of institutionalizations, subjectivities, possibilities of acting involved. So I'm wondering, in which respect do you consider art as the problem in relational art?
I think you've really identified the dilemma that we have, because in a sense it's the whole issue of the art world in which you remain, and even if you move out, you come back to it. It's it's some. I don't even know if I think in the context I'm talking about, it also stems from a belief in the possibility that world can make available to you to envisage. Something new, something different, and I think that's the way it's coming. And this is an individual act. I actually wanted also, implicitly, it's also the limits in which you are working. I think what is important here, I should mention, in the South Asian context, the whole concept of art is something that is. It's not, it's a migratory concept. It's a concept which has, over the generations, created forms of separation and has created enclaves of privilege and those exclusive. And I think today there is there's a claim towards towards using this epithet for forms of practice that that don't fall. Now, one example is about a community which lives away from the city, which doesn't, you know, a mental world is universe is far removed from the kinds of movements that you find in metropolitan centers, and yet there's a lot of so-called craft or artisanal practice going back in these centers, which takes place in these pockets. So you have these gallery spaces which are inhabited by a kind of English-speaking public who also have access to knowledge about what makes an object a work of art. And then you have people who work with other forms of knowledge. And now claiming this epithet for them. So there's a whole question of claims and contests and the denial of those claims. And there is a question of, again, a more philosophical tradition of bringing, you know, artisanship back, which comes again, you know, from the move, the initiative of the artist, and I think it's a kind of it's a paradoxical situation. So in a sense, you also, it's something which keeps you confined within certain structures, which are considered actually necessary to make this kind of production possible.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. I hope maybe we can go back to this discussion in the evening panel, because I think it's very important also to look at this question of labor division. And then say, I was just thinking of good old Marx, who said, like, art is not possible, it's not possible to produce art under the conditions of capitalism. But saying this kind of romantic, or I don't know whether it's romantic, it's just the idea that at some day we have a point where we can say there are just people who paint, there are just people who do this and that without this qualification. I think what you just said goes into this direction that there's a certain acknowledgement of different forms of producing without the need to immediately qualify. More questions from the audience, please. I think I can take one and a half. In the back, please. In the very back, there's the mic coming.
Thank you very much. I have a question which actually also dwells on this question of the division of labor, which goes back to the work that you mentioned earlier about this boat and the idea of subsuming a collective work of art, like a participatory, you called it, under the name of one artist and put it in a museum. Because it was a boat, I had immediately the connection to another quite historical work, let's call it a work of art, which also is a kind of a vehicle, which also was subsumed under one name but produced under immense division of labor, which is the Model T of Ford, right? So I was just wondering how you make this connection between this quite violent act of producing a massive division of labor with massive participatory workers, and then just call it the Ford because Henry Ford was obviously the one quite literally taking credit for it, and how this relates to this idea of going into a village and building a boat and then subsuming it under the name of one artist. And yeah.
It's not subsumed under the name of one artist, though. You know, the story, it's also about the way, you know, my access to this narrative is the narrative of the artist, okay? I don't have access to the subjectivities of the people involved. So that's, and that's something, I think, you know, it's a positionality that that I hope is clear. It's the... Maybe I should have shown you more images of the way it was displayed in the museum. I think the artist's authorship rests in the narrative and in the still pictures that are part of a show, whereas the boat is not his authorship. So that's a kind of an attempt to actually counter this whole Fordist division of labor.
Okay. One more last question. In the middle, Thorsten.
Sorry.
Well, there is no direct way in relations.
I wanted to come back to the idea of responsibility and how this is connected to the risk. My impression is that there is a very high risk for these artistic interventions into the art field and into the field of arts and crafts and political interventions that they fall between the gaps. So that there is a kind of double bind, which is very similar to the idea of Spivak. Can the subaltern speak? No, they can't. Because they are qualified in two different overlaying systems, and they are judged from two different directions, and whether nor they have, they don't have the chance to fulfill the promise they give. So is this kind of relational artistic intervention also the idea to get rid of the idea to produce a game changer in art or social politics, instead of becoming more relational, that we have to produce very, very small footsteps where we can change it, but in a long, long distance?
I think there are small steps. I think it's, you know, it's the same dilemma that that you pointed out, you know, who is speaking for whom. And I, you know, Atul Pala was in Heidelberg in the last summer. And again, it's all his narrative. It's through his voice that I hear the voice of the interlocutors whom he worked with and whom he spent these months in the village, and their responses. So it's, yeah, we come back to, It is a double bind, and I don't know, you know, I don't have the answer as to how we, from our positionality, can actually escape it. So it's these, any kind of narrative that we create, as, you know, as we as scholars have been, you know, critical scholars have learned to look for the gaps, the blind spots in the materials we use and the narratives that we have inherit, I think our own narratives will also have the same blind spots.
Yeah, well, inevitably. Yeah. Okay, so I leave us with the blind spots and hand over to Boaz, who will introduce the next speaker. And thank you again, Monica, for your talk and